are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, December 5th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the sixth time award-winning Majority Report? Is that some riff Sam was going on the other day?
Probably even more, but
I can't change it.
Who's counting?
Yeah.
Silver subscriber button owning.
The many, many, many times award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ronan Burton Shaw, editor of the Tribune. We're talking about whether or not the UK will save itself and vote for a Labour Party government. What are the prospects of Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell? The next wave of decimation planned by Boris Johnson and the Tories, and the absolute right-wing fraudulence of the Lib Dems. Also, how this election fits into the global context. Trump administration, you know, the isolationist and endless war ones. Well, they're considering deploying 14,000 additional troops in the Middle East. Interesting. Giuliani faces scrutiny over his dealings with the Ukrainians. Nancy Pelosi suggests there is no choice but impeachment, but her approach is wonky, funky. Moderate Dems warn against a kitchen sink impeachment push, even as this is already happening, folks. Warren and Biden lose ground. Sanders picks up significant ground in California days after Harris is out. Republicans face backlash, according to Modest headlines, and her challenger is banned from Twitter for calling for Ilhan Omar to be hanged, as the incitement and lying and terrorism campaign continues against her. Also,
the global campaign.
Yeah, there's global campaign. Seems like there's some Israeli propaganda going on against Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. What a shock that is. DC with the most absurd invite of the week. Wells Fargo is sponsoring an affordable housing panel. Pete Buttigieg's work at McKinsey is secret. Hillary Clinton is absolutely delusional, but she probably should have had Howard Stern interview her earlier. And former political prisoner and former Brazilian president Lula da Silva is free, organizing to save Brazilian democracy. Why is it that a infamous U.S. diplomat was just meeting with an appeals court of biased judges that just reaffirmed his sentence? That's a bit odd. Glenn Greenwald's interview with deposed Bolivian leader set to drop soon as the Bolivian coup regime. New video evidence emerges of yet more right-wing death squad activity. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. We are here, obviously, except without Sam. My understanding is that he is home reading bra ads, drinking some lemon water, and looking up Wikipedia articles of law professors. So he is getting recharged and renewed. And of course, we'll be here in full force Friday. Yesterday was the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Fred Hampton, who was assassinated and monitored by the U.S. surveillance state. Ken Klippenstein recently reported how the FBI still monitors so-called black identity extremists. Now, two quick points. One, I don't want the FBI monitoring anyone, regardless of how odious their belief is. They can be saying and talking about and whatever. I'm a civil libertarian in that sense. I only want them monitoring people that might actually commit a terrorist attack, whatever, you know, ideology they're representing, kill innocent people. And number two, that's the major point. But to be really clear, they're not doing some false, ridiculous equivalency like, oh, we're monitoring the Klan, but we're also monitoring, you know, some random sect that says they hate white people or whatever. Also would be, you know, ridiculous in all senses, in the civil libertarian sense that I mentioned first. But they're defining black identity extremists essentially as people fighting against police brutality, for criminal justice reform, and against violence in all different communities across the nation, where this is a serious and systemic problem, as we all know. So I want everybody to know that Fred Hampton is both not history in the sense that his analysis is relevant to today and his insight is relevant today, and the same forces that assassinated him are empowered today.
This depends on the education.
Well, the whole thing.
No, but it means this does. You can form this with no education. You can form this and this.
No, not the way we're talking about forming it. You know, right. We're talking about forming it right. You know, it's not on the paper. We didn't write it on the paper.
You can form it right with no education.
No.
Let me give you an example. Yomo Kenyatta formed the excellent revolution with no education. And on the day of the end thing, Yomo told the motherfucker, I said, well, you know, you've been educated to hate the enemy, but I'm your brother. I helped you lead the revolution. Now I'm more oppression. Another example, Papa Doc in Haiti. Papa Doc in Haiti hated everything white. Man, you couldn't put this white paper in front of Papa Doc's face. But he moved all the white people out and he took over and be oppressed when he did, because of no education. And the people that have been educated, they just said that we don't hate the motherfucker white people, we hate the oppressor, whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow. So we got to know the educational program to find out what is going to be in the finale. A lot of people, Yomo Kenyatta is called not a never a revolutionary, but an ex-revolutionary. So it was Papa Doc. They brought on a successful revolution. That thing in the Mau was a bitch. Bantu freedom fighters, all that kind of action. But what we're saying is, this is the end. That you don't judge Castro now. You can't do it. Nobody in this room could judge whether Castro was going to be a revolutionary or not. You know what I mean? We're talking about things, you know what I mean, with China, the People's Republic, and even at the stage they're in now, talking about even going on further into a communistic state. That's what we're talking about. That was a revolutionary. So we got to understand here the educational program that you have to be able to figure out whether it will go on the right lines, where the people will end up in a situation where they can be able to really control themselves. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, the people that take this local foundation and start stealing money because they won't be really educated to why it's the people's thing anyway. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, you have neocolonialism instead of colonialism like you got in Africa now, like you got in Haiti. So what we're talking about is there has to be an educational program. That's very important. As a matter of fact, we're so important for us that a person has to go through 6 weeks of our political education before he can consider himself a member of the party, able to even run down ideology for the party. Why? Because if they don't have an education, then they're nowhere. You dig what I'm saying? They're nowhere because they don't even know why they're doing what they're doing. You might get people caught up in an emotionalist movement. You understand me? You might get them caught up in because they're poor and they want something. And then if they're not educated, they want more. And before you know it, they'll be capitalists. And before you know it, we'll have Negro imperialists.
Well, that, of course, that's, you know, that reflects, again, Adolf Reed's indispensable work and Walter Rodney and Milton Alamadi and other people who've done the kind of the neocolonialist critiques. And I mean, look, this is also in the context where he's generating and building some of the most important political alliances in the context of his time across racial and economic boundaries in a Marxist and liberatory framework. And he's also getting spied on, surveilled, terrorized, and eventually assassinated. And he's only in his early 20s.
Yeah, that's a crazy thing. Whenever you hear him talk, break things down like that,
yes.
He's 20. I don't know. I couldn't break down any subject matter at age 20 like that.
No.
Yeah, it's interesting that they refer to him as a black identity extremist, because that's really a minimization of what he was and what he was about, because he understood you cannot take on white supremacy without taking on capitalism too. And he was uniting workers of all races in a project that was very subversive and threatening to the status quo. Can I read a quote from Fred Hampton?
Please.
This is a good one. He said, "We got to face some facts. that the masses are poor, that the masses belong to what you call the lower class. And when I talk about the masses, I'm talking about the white masses. I'm talking about the black masses and the brown masses and the yellow masses, too. We've got to face the fact that some people say you fight fire best with fire, but we say you put fire out best with water. We say you don't fight racism with racism. We're going to fight racism with solidarity. We say you don't fight capitalism with black capitalism. You fight capitalism with socialism. Mm. And that goes to the heart of so much of what we're always talking about on this show, I think. And like kind of hits at this like zero sum game argument that we're always having with Sam.
But Fred, it's a zero sum game. That would be quite a debate. With the cold months approaching, nothing sounds better than curling up next to a warm fire, sipping a cup of hot cocoa, and cracking open an intricate homicide investigation. Cue Hunt a Killer, the subscription box game, the subscription game that thrusts you and your friends and family into an ongoing murder mystery investigation. With every delivery, you'll sift through piles of documents, evidence, audio recordings, and case files, eliminating suspects until you solve the case and catch the killer. No wonder they have 2,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. 2,000 five-star, that's actually a lot. Sam's playing it with his fam. He raves about it, not only on air, but in the office. He talks about how fun it is to have something that is off technology, that's not on the phone, that's not on the computer, that is actually really interesting, that's like brain work. And then also, you know, it's
makes
like
his kids pay attention to
makes
him.
Makes his kids pay attention to him. It's related. It's like the TV, but it's not the TV at all because it's engaged. He goes on and on and on. And it sounds incredibly fun. I actually think we should basically do the thing in the office. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com and use promo code MAJORITY to get 20% off your first box. They even have a gift card for all of your holiday shopping. Not to mention they're throwing in exclusive bundles for the holiday season. So make sure to use promo code MAJORITY at huntakiller.com for a 20% discount and show your support for the show. That's huntakiller.com. Promo code MAJORITY. The problem that keeps so many businesses from knowing their numbers is a hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, and it takes up way too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. That is 100% true, particularly if you're running a small business, and not only do you not, I mean, of course, you don't want resources wasted, but you also need to fight for your time. You need to fight to not have every second of your day eaten up by redundant logistics so you can deliver actual good work, great work, and have a life. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform that gives you visibility, gives you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud system, cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow profits at netsuite.com/majority. That's netsuite.com/majority to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, netsuite.com/majority. And finally, there has been a significant visual upgrade in the office. And of course, I'm talking about Sam's footwear. Karayuma marries old school designs and new school ethics for sneakers that are good looking, crazy comfy, and consciously made. With an obsessive eye for detail, they make their sneakers by hand with premium natural materials, including cotton sourced from fair trade initiatives. They also make their outsole using raw natural rubbers and ensure that factory workers earn their wages and experience safe working conditions. Earn fair wages and experience safe working conditions. These are important things, and they can't, and they don't, and they don't, and they just don't, sorry, These are important things, and they just don't compromise. Even their packaging is made from recycled and 100% recyclable materials, plus they make up carbon emissions released during transportation by purchasing carbon offsets, creating a shipping footprint at a balance of zero. Best of all, their brand new IRI sneakers is knit from self-generating bamboo and recycled plastics from heel to toe. I experience looking at the first piece of footwear that Sam has ever worn that I think I will buy myself.
Wow. That's a ringing endorsement.
That is revolutionary. Previous grade for Sam's footwear was woo or okay. Now it's like, damn, those look really, really good. And it's awesome how ecologically sustainable they are. I want a pair. I was stunned. For a limited time, our listeners can get 15% off of your first pair of Karayuma sneakers. They ship worldwide, and they offer express shipping in the USA. Plus, if for any reason they don't fit perfectly, you can return them free of charge. That is so. That's awesome. So go to Karayuma.com/majority to get 15% off. That's Karayuma.com/majority for 15% off. We're going to take a brief break, folks, and we are going to come back with Ronan Burton Shaw to talk about whether the UK will avert Tory catastrophe. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Just had actually some really nice conversation with our friend in Dublin. Thank you so much for setting that up. I don't know if I should say the name, but I appreciate you. And now joining us is our friend Ronan Burton Shaw. He's the editor of Tribune Magazine. Ronan, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks very much, guys. Sorry about that confusion at the start. How's things?
Things are good. Very happy to be talking with you. So take us, you know, I've been following this UK election quite a bit. I think the stakes, obviously, I mean, I think really things like the NHS are obviously the very nature of the basic social infrastructure of the United Kingdom are at stake here. What are the main forces, though, for people who maybe haven't been paying as much attention? Can you give us a run through of the Tories, of Labour, of the Lib Dems, any other relevant parties? And also, you know, the bigger ideological questions, but, you know, a lot of questions people have about, you know, tactical voting, how the system actually works, these types of things. Just ground us in the 2019 UK general election.
Yeah, so the system over here is a first-past-the-post system, right? That's the first and most important thing to kind of lay out there, which means that tactical voting in a certain number of cases is something that you see quite a bit during elections, but only in very specific areas. So we don't have what a lot of European systems have, which is single transferable vote or proportional representation, which means votes can be transferred. So on, it literally is the candidate that gets over first. In that way, it's pretty similar to the American system. And so where, for instance, you have a candidate who's a Tory MP, there's a Labour MP, then be trying to convince voters of other Lib Dems, Greens, or whatever to vote for that Labour MP. And similarly enough, if you have a Tory MP and the nearest is Liberal Democrat, well then you do have sites that are arguing for voting that way. But it is pretty important to lay out that it's difficult to know with the polling landscape at the moment where individual seats are going. Because last time in 2017, the scale of Labour's comeback in the final weeks of that campaign meant that the party won a lot of seats that quite simply had never even been considered Labour territory beforehand. Places like Canterbury, where the Tories were safe not only for, you know, decades, but going back in, you know, centuries in the vote. So, you know, those tactical voting sites and that kind of discussion, I think, is something you have to be relatively sceptical of, particularly because the Liberal Democrat vote is on the decline, the Labour vote is on the up. Sorry, can you guys hear me there?
Yeah, Ronan, we can hear you. I mean, it's a little bit of a funky connection. I don't know if we have an alternative, but we can hear you. If this needs to be, it works. Tell us then about the stakes of the election and on the positive end, the incredible things that Labour's putting on the table. I mean, they put out a really great manifesto. And then the danger of the Tories, but I think it's also really important to talk about how Dominic Cummings, who's Boris Johnson's main strategist and the architect of the Brexit campaign, how they are definitely part of this, you know, this populist right that certainly understands that they should be lying about austerity, which they are. And then also, you know, the Lib Dems and really just, yeah, they're wreckers and they're partners in destroying the UK, if I might editorialize.
Sure.
I think people need to be really clear about that.
Yeah, well, look, the battle that's going on in Britain now is a very specific one. It is a battle along class lines. So whereas previously, in the kind of 2000s and the new Labour era, you had a Labour Party that was very centre-left, moderate, pro-corporate interests and so forth, that did things like brought private financing into the NHS. And now, under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, you've got a solidly left-wing Labour Party, a Labour Party which is standing on a platform of increasing minimum wage, scrapping anti-union laws, introducing a Green New Deal, properly renationalising and kicking out the private interests from the NHS, increasing funding for education, ending some of the really miserable welfare policies over here, like universal credit, which are pushing thousands and thousands of people into poverty, building a million council houses over a 10-year period. So the Labour Party now has an ambitious socialist manifesto and platform led by people, and Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell and Diane Abbott, who are lifelong socialists, people who were socialists when it was not, you know, to be frank, so trendy as it may be is for this generation, right, to be socialist. They were socialists when it really meant that they were on the complete fringes. They were MPs in a group of five and six and seven who were totally outside of any question of power. They laughed at and mocked by the media, basically, for their criticisms of capitalism. And now they lead a major party, one of the most significant parties in the Western world, if you think of its longevity, if you think of its size, of its membership, with about 500,000 members, if you think of the historic role that the Labour Party has played in upholding capitalism in Britain, and obviously Britain having been one of the historic powers on the world stage and maintaining the capitalist system. So we have an incredibly radical, in one sense, when you look at a true history and so forth, proposition here, which is that we have a real socialist elected to 10 Downing Street. And on the other side, we have a radicalizing Tory party. So this is not, you know, the Tory party of David Cameron either. All of these kind of old coordinates are really being thrashed in this era, a bit like in the United States, you know, this is no longer the kind of longed for moderate Republican Party of the New York Times columnists and whatever. And now you've got the Republican Party of Donald Trump, where the mask is kind of ripped off and the reality of their politics are exposed. And it's quite similar with Boris Johnson. He's running a hard Brexit Tory party on a platform which is basically to exit the European Union, but do it in a specific way, which tears up rights and protections, tears up workers' rights, health and safety, so on, does a free trade agreement with the United States, opens up the National Health Service and God knows what other parts of the public sector to private and international investment, puts a kind of Margaret Thatcher on steroids program. And he's doing all this also as a figure who has, you know, consistently been a provocateur for racist right-wing politics. Somebody who, when he was a columnist, made his life out of being one of those people who deliberately tried to annoy liberal opinion, who said things like Muslim women looked like letterboxes when they were burqas. Called black people pickaninnies, yep. Made all kinds of derogatory comments about single mothers, which we were just discussing this week, and how their children are more, you know, propensity to violence and all the rest of it. So this is a guy who, you know, I don't think in America you would find it that hard to imagine those kind of figures, right? You know who they are. Well, one of them is the Prime Minister here, and he's leading this Conservative Party in this election, and it's him against Jeremy Corbyn. As you said, there is a third force, the Lib Dems. There's also the question of Scotland and the SNP and so on, we'll maybe come to in a minute. But the third force, the Liberal Democrats, who, you know, were doing very well for a period coming up to this election because basically they had the backing of Liberal business interests. They positioned themselves entirely around the Brexit question. There were these big lobby groups like the People's Vote who were pushing all the time that what had to happen with Brexit is the whole thing had to be overturned. We had to have the, you know, a new referendum, and actually the Dems went so far as saying just we would revoke the vote altogether in this election. And they did that partly because what they want a, you know, a left option on the table, or an option that, you know, people who don't like, you know, Boris Johnson or Donald Trump style politics can vote for, which doesn't imply challenging corporate power, redistributing wealth, rebuilding the welfare state, giving, you know, power to workers. Because the Lib Dems, of course, were the coalition partners of the Conservatives between 2010 and 2015, during the period when the very worst austerity that was imposed in Britain was brought in, and they signed off on all of it. So they're kind of a party that represents, the kind of liberal business interests, people who are very concerned about people being respectful in their political discourse and don't like the idea of a boorish Boris Johnson, but also don't want to solve any of the kind of underlying social problems that lead to the creation and the rise of figures like Boris Johnson in the first place.
And also, just to really underline, because I've been noticing, I mean, it's so funny. I get the same kind of neurotic concern trolling now from people in the UK when I talk about the Lib Dems. And, you know, if I had confidence that there was some, you know, discredited trash centrist party, but they were going to coalition with Labour, and they had made that commitment and so on, I might be more open to it. But my to the so-called tactical question voting, tactical voting question, which you've already actually discredited and runs against the evidence we have of the Labour resurgence of 2017, which might definitely repeat itself here. But they've said quite explicitly themselves that they are not going to support a Corbyn government. They will not team with Labour. They're absolutely committed to the same austerity program that, you know, caused so much devastation and havoc the last time they had power. So, I mean, you know, as you, I think you've said it. I mean, I guess if you're a Tory who's, you know, far right wing, but doesn't feel so comfortable with like overt racism, that's your vote. But if you're anybody else and you're concerned about something like saving the NHS or dealing with the roots of the resurgence of far right populism, I mean, the Lib Dems are sort of like the classic case study of what facilitated the crisis we're in.
I would agree. I mean, my own view of it is I've done quite a bit of door knocking for Labour in this election. It's actually where it just was before this call. And, you know, you run into people who are well-meaning, who are voting Lib Dem. They're people who kind of, you know, the whole conversation in the media has been so focused on Brexit for so long, for the exclusion of every other problem, that people have been, to some degree, blinded about what the Lib Dems' record really is. And you're speaking to a person on the door, and you're like, well, you know, do you support all of these austerity policies that the Lib Dems are responsible for? Do you think we should be funding the NHS? Do you believe there should be a higher minimum wage? Are you a fan of, for instance, one of the things the Lib Dems did notoriously when they were in government, which was that they massively increased the fees workers had to pay to go to employment tribunals if they were unfairly sacked? I mean, are you a fan of that kind of stuff? And people are not. And they say, you know, I hadn't thought about that, because it wasn't being put forward. The critical line about, you know, what the Lib Dems had done before wasn't being put forward. And I have to be honest, I think it's part of a very serious structural problem in the British media, which is that a lot of British journalists, particularly editors and the people who own the big newspapers, they really don't want Corbyn's arguments to be on the pitch. They want it to be a culture war battle between, you know, people with nice liberal social views, people with conservative social views, and the economic question can be basically written off. And that is why the Liberal Democrats will always be their preferred kind of non-Tory option. That's why they'll always push their kind of their policies, their politics, instead of the Labour Party in its current form. Because once you get to a point where people are actually asked the economic questions, another big thing that I haven't even mentioned about Labour's platform yet is renationalisation, right? So Labour are proposing to renationalise rail, mail, energy, water. These are things that, if you look at the polls, there's overwhelming support. These things have 70, 80% support in the polls time after time after time. And there is a huge consensus behind the need for economic change, the ending of privatization, some serious action about economic inequality and regional inequality in Britain. But the media doesn't want to talk about it. It almost never came up over the last 18 months, because all we discussed in Brexit was the technical details, how Britain was going to leave, what was the latest battle going on in Parliament, which MP was throwing a fit today over which part of the Brexit thing. It was a drama located within about a 1 kilometre square, 2 kilometre square space, and it neglected all of the other issues that actually led to the Brexit vote in the first place. And when you consistently frame politics that way, and there, you know, there is no major newspaper outlet in this country, I think it's worth saying to your listeners, there's not one whose editorial line backs Corbyn. There are a number that, you know, are favourable to Labour, but when the question came about Corbyn's leadership, all of them, The Guardian, The Mirror, and The New Statesman, who actually won't even back Labour in this election, they all were in favor of Corbyn going. So there isn't a single media outlet of any size in this country that backs Corbyn's leadership. And so they have simply been involved in ruling his economic and political agenda off the table and narrowing a conversation around Brexit to culture war issues, which, as we know, and as I'm sure people on the left in the United States know, is a dead end for us, because ultimately, you know, confining the political debate to why people vote for someone like a Donald Trump and only looking at, you know, his rhetoric and how boorish he is and whatever, and not looking at some of the factors, for instance, in the Midwest, about long-term economic decline, the Democratic Party abandoning part of its traditional core, the fact that if you don't look at those questions, well, then it always ends up a mystery.
Right, absolutely. It's a mystery, and then the only answers are like religious almost. And you know, it's like you just can kind of do incantations. But what, I mean, get us deeper into just how dangerous the UK media is and why they've waged this unrelenting war against Corbyn. And if you could connect it, I mean, actually, you already explained the why, but maybe just a little bit more details into the monopolies and how they affect it. But then maybe connect it to this incredible conversation about anti-Semitism. Because one, I mean, look, I think that from where I see it, there's a little bit more sort of overt anti-Semitism across the board in the UK than there is in the United States, though that's changing. We've got a press corps approved group that are talking about Jukus here, White House press corps approved. But the Conservative Party in the UK, in both its like traditional, like inbred grandee tradition, these are not fans of Jewish people. The former Speaker of the Parliament, John Bercow, in an interview a couple weeks ago where he said, of course, Jeremy Corbyn is not an anti-Semite and is a member of the Conservative Party, and said, look, I've never experienced any anti-Semitism from Labour. I have maybe experienced it from some other parties or party in the UK. And then in the very modern 2019 version, Boris Johnson has apparently been advised by Steve Bannon. He is tight with Donald Trump. There are the same types of spillovers of all of the new, you know, alt-right Nazi type movements, you know, currying their influence, as they are obviously in the United States, in the UK, even as one, Corbyn and the leadership have condemned anti-Semitism. And then, of course, the other issue that gets involved here is, you know, the conflation of absolutely correct, essential and valid criticism of the, you know, of the state of Israel conducting, you know, brutal, horrific, systemic human rights abuses on a daily basis and making that anti-Semitism. So, you know, those three things need to be kind of teased apart. And I think the media thing connects because, yes, I mean, if you read the UK, I mean, there's a big bias against Sanders here. If you read the UK press, it would make Sanders look like he was getting, you know, the press coverage of, you know, Beyonce.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, I have some degree of knowledge of what's going on with the US coverage of Sanders, and I know it is very skewed against them. But as you say, it's nowhere near as skewed as the coverage over here about Corbyn. And I think the part of the reason is that the left has been off the pitch for a longer time in the United States. And so your kind of media culture is not as well organized in demonizing the, you know, insurgent socialist figures. Whereas here, particularly because of what we had in the 1970s and 1980s, and you think of things like the miners' strike and all of that, you have a press that's very well able, organized around demonizing left-wing and socialist figures. They know how to do it. And in Jeremy Corbyn's case, they went around everything until they found one that stuck. And that's the truth of it, right? So it was Jeremy Corbyn is a fan of the IRA. Jeremy Corbyn is friends with Hamas. Jeremy Corbyn, won't sing the national anthem. He didn't bow sufficiently at the cenotaph. What did he, you know, what does he think about the Queen? In fact, just today, two of the major newspapers are running front page stories about how Jeremy Corbyn doesn't know the time of the Queen's speech on Christmas Day.
Oh,
it's
my God.
Absurd. It's completely absurd.
That's just so, that's so offensive, Ronan. Jesus Christ.
I know, yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, as an Irishman, that's not going to lose many votes with me. But the bigger picture here is that, you know, they went around until they found something that sticks. And that is this question, the anti-Semitism controversy. Exactly as you said, I think that this is, you know, one part of an international question that everyone on the left is going to have to grapple with in coming years, where we've got figures like, say, Viktor Orban, who have very well-established anti-Semitic links to far-right groups, who want to rewrite the whole history of the Holocaust in Eastern Europe in order to justify the right on nationalist forces and demonize the actual partisans who fought against the Nazis. And these people are now being held up as friends of the Jewish people because they are pro-Israel. Right. And this is happening, you know, in many, many countries with many right-wing demagogues. Basically, it's been a policy of the Netanyahu government to bring in anyone who's willing to back Israel on, human rights abuses, the occupation, settlements, Jerusalem as the capital of these questions. And if they're willing to do that, they become somebody who's going to get a lot of press for being friends of the Jewish people, even if their record is very deeply anti-Semitic. Right. And that is reflected here. So where you've got a situation, as you say, that historically in Britain, the left was the home of Jewish politics. You know, if you think of some of the great figures of the British left in recent decades, people like Eric Hobsbawm, people like Ralph Miliband, it was always the case for a very, very long time that the Jewish people in Britain gravitated towards the left, and the left was the kind of pillar against the aristocratic anti-Semitism that ran through so many parts of British society, and particularly the Tory party. And Jeremy Corbyn obviously comes through from an era where those figures, particularly the two I mentioned, people like Hobsbawm and Miliband, were, you know, the key thinkers in shaping generations of the left and their worldview. And so, you know, it has really been turned on its head through the last number of years. You had previously seen a kind of, by degree, a migration of vote from Jewish communities towards the Tories and so on. But this controversy has really changed that historic kind of perspective. Whereas now, the only time we're hearing discussion in the press about Jewish people in this election is to say that the people can't vote for the Labour Party, can't vote for them, and so on. The truth of it is Jeremy Corbyn actually was a friend of some of the most progressive and radical Jewish people in this country. I think of Max Levitas, who was there at the Battle of Cable Street when Jewish people and Irish working class people gathered together to fight against Oswald Mosley and the Union of British Fascists and drive them back from Cable Street in London. At a key moment when it really was possible that fascism was on the rise in Britain. Well, Max Levitas lived to, 100, 101, 102, whatever age it was. And in his final years, he spent many of them sharing stages with Jeremy Corbyn at anti-fascist and anti-racist rallies. Right. So Jeremy Corbyn has a very strong record of standing up for the persecuted and the oppressed in general. But partly because this whole international conversation has been reshaped on the terms that I was just saying, where so much of what is, when you go in on Google now and you type in anti-Semitism and you look at the news stories, so much of it is now pivoting around the question of who's, you know, a friend of the Jewish people because they're willing to give uncritical support to Israel and who is not or an enemy of Jewish people because they have a different perspective.
Right. So one Jeremy Corbyn being a thorough, across-the-board anti-racist and supporter of justice for all in this sick, fascistic worldview, we're going back, at least 15 years. I mean, where, you know, Likud and the right specifically have very self-consciously partnered with the evangelical right in the United States and neo-fascists across Europe. And of course, that includes, you know, elements of Tory and Republican Party. Then they can somehow pull off this, you know, lie and fraud about Jeremy Corbyn because, you know, he holds the views on Palestinian rights that, I mean, you know, any decent person would hold.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. Look, one of the difficulties that we have here is that anti-Semitism is a very specific form of racism, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're simultaneously saying that people are subhuman and that they're controlling the world. Right? This is the reason why anti-Semitism is specific and complex. We're faced with a media environment that wants to take this issue and simply use it to slander Jeremy Corbyn. Doesn't really have any interest in the question of, well, how do we tackle anti-Semitism in the 21st century and what does it look like? They're interested in taking this question and slandering Corbyn with it. I think the left has a greater responsibility there to think ourselves through some of these questions. And ask, you know, is it possible that, say, for instance, a lot of people who gravitate towards the left for the first time, who haven't been that interested in politics and so forth, you know, they see some injustice in Israel, they go onto Google and type in the word Zionist, and they can find, you know, things that are quite straightly wrong and anti-Semitic and, you know, conspiracies about the Rothschilds and whatever. Like, yep. we have to be real, but we actually care about the issue and say that happens and we've got to fight against it.
Right.
But this is not, you know, characteristic of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party has a lot of left-wing Jewish people in it, a lot of left-wing Jewish people backing his agenda very strongly. In fact, the people who are most active in the anti-fascist and anti-racist struggles in this country are almost uniformly behind Corbyn and the Labour Party. And it is just really unfortunate that we have this situation that has actually a sense amongst a lot of people who are maybe not that political in the Jewish community, when they're seeing headline after headline in the press day after day about Corbyn, you know, being an anti-Semite, that people have a concern about what that means, you know, and if this guy gets elected. And in my view, you know, that is a deeply irresponsible thing for the press to be convincing people of. Well, you've got a community that has a history of persecution and so on, to portray a figure like Jeremy Corbyn, who, yes, people might agree with his position on Israel. He made one muck-up about a mural, which were, you know, became the big story of all of it.
That was absolutely a mistake of his, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I mean, we should talk about that incident, right?
Okay,
because I think
ahead.
It's worth doing.
Yep.
Where it was on, so it was a mural in his constituency. Some guy had put it up, and there was, like, you know, basically New World Order style stuff on it, which had anti-Semitic overtones without question. And Corbyn liked and commented something on Facebook about, you know, the council was going to take it down, and he was opposed to it. Almost certainly because, you know, this guy was a local artist who was trying to put up what he considered a political message and whatever, and Corbyn was trying to give him some support.
Right.
He should have looked at that more clearly. When he did, he apologized for it, but it was a stupid mistake. But taking that and moving it into a point where we are now, where people, you know, are being told that their future in the country is under threat, they will be persecuted, it's so incredibly irresponsible. And it has created a serious problem. Luckily, during this campaign, there have been a lot more prominent left-wing Jewish voices. I think of people like David Graeber, the academic, who came out with a statement the other day that went viral on Twitter, where he talked about this and he said, you know, I'm a Jewish person. I have a great knowledge of the history of persecution of Jews as somebody who's a historian and anthropologist. And I can say without any question that people who want to stop the next wave of persecution of Jews should be voting for the socialists and not somebody who's palling up with far-right figures like Viktor Orban across Europe.
100%. In 2017, that was actually a story of the polls being wrong and missing a huge grassroots outpouring of support for Corbyn's Labour Party and for democratic socialism. Do you, I saw some encouraging numbers recently on a spike in young people registering to vote, which is obviously a great signal for Labour. The Lib Dems are collapsing. That's obviously really positive. What do you, I mean, you know, this is the what do you think might happen here question. Does Labour have a shot at forcing a hung parliament, denying the Tories the power to complete their destruction?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I think it's a tough one. And I think this is a question that the left internationally is going to have to grapple with, you know. We're facing huge structural obstacles. The total kind of power of concentrated wealth being against us, all of the big media being against us. In Britain, you know, the political apparatus in the Labour Party, most of it being against them for most of this time. To overcome all of those obstacles and get radical policies introduced is a very hard thing to do. It's part of the reason why, you know, there has been this inexorable drift towards inequality across the world, is that it's a very hard thing to overcome the obstacles in our way. But every time the Labour Party gets into an election campaign, what do we see? We see that the poll difference that have been there tightens because people get exposed to the actual arguments.
Right.
Some bizarre distortion presented by Rupert Murdoch-owned media, or I mean, give you a context, right? 60% of the newspapers read in this country every day are about two companies, the Daily Mail Group and Rupert Murdoch's News UK. I mean, that's 60%, right? So they are pushing out every single day into thousands of homes. They are pushing out anti-Corbyn propaganda. And then it isn't until people get to experience an election campaign where Labour mobilises, you know, 500,000 people to knock on doors, to campaign for the party and to talk about their actual policies and what they would mean for people's lives, we see a resurgence. And this has happened in 2017, and now we're seeing it again in 2019. The question of whether we can overcome the scale of the obstacles, you know, in such a short period of time or just a few weeks where people are actually being encouraged to listen to things about the NHS again. No one has talked about the NHS for so long with Brexit. It's just been like off the table and not considered. And then people are being given just a few kind of weeks and this short, sharp shock to think about the NHS, their kids' schools, their wages, all of these questions. Whether we can do it, I'm not sure. There are some positive signs. The gap is closing again for the reason I've said. A lot of the polling companies are using models for this election that are based on low turnout amongst young people, like significantly down, about a quarter or a third down under 35 from the last election. And some of them go up to like having significantly lower turnout under 50. I would be surprised if that happens, but it could. I mean, the December election had a lot of problems to us. A lot of people are working terrible shifts, you know, Christmas shifts. It's cold out there. You know, it's a very different atmosphere to the June election. But the voter registration information indicates something else. It's the largest increase that we have seen in the modern times of young people registering to vote. Whether or not that can tip Labour over, I don't know. I have to say that there are, you know, I'm one of these people who gets a bit worried when politics gets realigned as young versus old basis and whatever, not only because it can be damaging to kind of class politics, but also because the record is like very clear, right, that older people come out and vote and they do it reliably and they do it in big numbers and younger people are less so. But it is certainly the case that a lot of young people have registered to vote. And if those registration numbers are reflected in turnout, then the polling rules that we've seen, you will not be right. There might still be a Tory majority, we don't know, but it simply won't be the case if those registration numbers are reflected that we're going to have a huge, like one-third drop in under 35 voting while millions of young people have registered. That seems unlikely.
Ronan Burton Shaw, Solidarity good luck. If you're in the UK, my God, don't fuck around. Vote for Labour. Thanks so much, man.
Thanks. I appreciate it, guys.
All right, folks. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. That's how you fight all of the media monopolies that propagandize this world. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. Then, of course, become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS. Check out last night's or Tuesday's conversation with Big Waz, Wozni Lambre, and Slavoj Žižek, which was brilliant. This Sunday, for patrons, an in-depth deep dive on the history from today to 2011 of Egypt, what happened and why. And then you can see a link on the Majority.fm homepage, the Bell House, February 7th, TMBS is back live. We just sold out Philly. It was an amazing show. It was great. Everybody loved it. It was fantastic. Thank you. And this one's, we're just going to do like a mega show, taking it back in New York. We've got Pretty Bad Lefty, BJ Sutton, joining us. We've got Alona Minkowski. What?
BJ is going to be in studio tomorrow for Majority Report, actually.
Rad. He's joining us. Alona Minkowski is joining us. Harvey Kay is joining us. Ben Burgess is joining us. And there's going to be one other secret to be announced. Get your tickets today. I can tell you they're going fast. And in the previous shows, we filled it up, but you could come and buy it at the box office. I swear to God, in Philly, I walked in. There was a woman. She said hi, shook hands. She said, I'm waiting to see if there's any extra tickets because it's sold out. So don't do that. Snag your tickets to the Bell House today, February 7th. Incredibly excited. Also, if you haven't yet subscribed to Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, we're at 91,000 subs and want to get to 100,000 subs before the new year. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, Sean sits down with fellow socialist train guy, Justin Rozniak, a.k.a. Do Not Eat. He's a big bread tuber, to get at the real and sordid history behind the 1988 blockbuster Who Framed Roger Rabbit. How was this crazy film made? What does it tell us about the history of public transit in Los Angeles and elsewhere? Why is Elon Musk full of crap? How would the rail fit into the Green New Deal and socialism in general? And more importantly, how did our fans get us to watch hentai? Because that's basically what Who Framed Roger Rabbit is. It's a sexy cartoon. Check it out. Also, still want to plug my show from last week. Think it's really important. I spoke with three organizers from the world of sex work. Rachel Rabbit White, Nina Lowe from Decrim NY, and Oyster, about organizing in the world of sex work and why socialists should care about decriminalization as a workers' rights issue and not just some kind of libertarian thing. And then we had a real Kolintai Hours with the same guests on Friday for our patrons, wherein modern-day workers read Kolintai's 100-year-old treatise on prostitution and ways of fighting it, and kind of evaluated it in terms of our lives today. So check it out, patreon.com/theantifada.
Kolintai, folks. Great stuff.
More and more people have been talking about
her. More and more people actually have been talking about her. For good reason.
Literary Hangover, we talk about Arthur Miller, why he said market capitalism is ruining or killed the theater, and McCarthyism and the Salem witch trials and what those two things share in common.
That is terrifyingly relevant for everything we're talking about. Folks, Hunt a Killer is a subscription game that thrusts you and your friends and your family into an ongoing murder mystery investigation. With every delivery, you'll sift through piles of documents, evidence, audio recordings, and case files, eliminating suspects until you solve the case and catch the killer. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com and use promo code MAJORITY to get 20% off your first box. They even have gift cards for all holiday shopping, not to mention they're throwing in exclusive bundles for the holiday season. So make sure to use promo code MAJORITY at huntakiller.com for 20% discount to show your support for the show. huntakiller.com, code majority. All right, folks, we'll see you on the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back.
It started, it did not move back, with a constitution.
And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. 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 And the alpha males are back. 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 Back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Blasphemy around here. I am a total pussy, total,
pussy, total,
pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, total, pussy, 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 puss